This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena to better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, we're going to talk about Lacan again, Sharat, and his theory of the gaze. But first things first, though, I want to welcome you back. You haven't been around for a while. You were out for various reasons over 2 months. So
yeah,
welcome back.
I think, thank you very much. It was the sabbatical for a couple of weeks, and then I came back from that and promptly fell ill. I've been struggling with that for a while, and you can still hear it in my voice. It's like, you know, kind of hoarseness there, you know, as a result of, well, whatever it is, don't neglect your health, you know, and don't let things get from, you know, mild to acute. I think that's the one lesson I've learned so late in my life, and maybe we should start a whole new show called, you know,
facing mortality or
no, what philosophy for life or something. I think it's being done in the UK where philosophers came together to set up this thing where they talk about various issues that pertain to real life concerns that people have, and to bring some clarity, which I think is what, you know, philosophy and in fact much of the social sciences tries to do. It tries to bring clarity, and so to things like, you know, health,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
you know, maintaining your good health. So.
But what we can try to do in the meantime is to bring clarity to some of the dense stuff that Lacan is often associated with.
Yeah, we've talked about Lacan before.
A few times, yeah.
And the interest in him is that he takes that whole psychoanalytic tradition a step further, right? I mean, he really sees it, I mean, is it were kind of in language, isn't he? And mm-hmm. that's his, in some sense, step forward with the whole psychoanalytic tradition.
Correct. So he is going to inaugurate a movement in France, which is often labeled as a return to Freud. And this began shortly after the war. And
this is World War One or
War
Two.
Okay,
so you know, for some of us, you know, the war could be many things. It could be Syria today or the Gulf Wars.
You're right,
you know,
you're right,
it's a generational thing when we talk about the war.
This was Lacan's war, I guess, the war in his context, and he saw the dominance of this thing called ego psychology as a betrayal to what Freud was trying to do. So I think, as we've discussed on a few occasions before, the structure of personhood that Freud offers is layered in three different ways, right? So you have the id, the ego, and superego, and the psychoanalytic strand of Lacan's time saw the ego as something that's very central to our conception of the subject. And Lacan, in introducing language, was to initiate a move against that.
Who would represent this focus on the ego, ego psychology or mm-hmm. Psychoanalysis, but who would the names be associated with this?
Well, Anna Freud started that move.
The daughter of Freud,
yeah. Formulating the ego as this bastion against the infiltrating drives, right? So the way Freud had conceived of the human person was that we're always carrying this internal struggle between our so-called civilized side, which is, I guess, culminated in the ego, right? The idea that we are self-governing, the idea that we are in many ways able to be transparent to ourselves through a certain rational process. And on the other hand, you have the id, which is represented by our drives, which in many ways is more ancient because it's the residue of our evolutionary journey. So that school gave more attention and primacy to ego in our personality.
You know, I think when you, this issue of, you know, being self-governing and, you know, being able to kind of think yourself through and talk yourself through, you know, many of your problems, mm-hmm. I think people, if you put that to them, they will say, yes, that's obviously true, and they would subscribe to that. But as soon as you ask them to kind of reflect on their attempts to change very basic habits that they have, mm-hmm. and how difficult those are, mm-hmm. you know, ways of thinking about the world, or even the way in which they might give advice to a friend and say, well, you just have to think positive, or you have to, you know, mm-hmm. overcome this. And then have that great advice fall on deaf ears,
yeah.
and this the kind of resistance to change. And I think once you are aware of that resistance, you know something else is going on
yeah.
with the human person than just what they say about themselves
exactly.
and what they think about themselves. You know, there's some deep well that we don't access so easily or readily.
We can all relate to this through everyday examples like dieting.
Love dieting. That's my favorite example.
That's a great example of how difficult self-governance can be, right? Or trying to quit smoking or certain problems in intimacy and sexuality and stuff like that. That's where you see the limits of what our ego can tell about us, right? And the ego essentially is just the I that narrates the inner voice, right? That gives us some semblance of control, the idea that we have a center, right, that can oversee our entire personhood. But like you said, it's much easier said than done.
So where do we go from here?
So this is where we extend that insight, right? The difficulties or limits of mastery over the self into the domain of vision and looking. And the way that Lacan uses the gaze, this concept, is very different than how much our social theory uses it, right? Where we think of the gaze in voyeuristic terms, right? So, for example, notions of the male gaze or the panopticon, whereby vision is associated with power, mastery, definition, and a kind of penetration of the object, right? Lacan is going to give a different twist to that. And as we mentioned previously, when we're talking about the difficulties or the limits of autonomy, right? Lacan's notion of the gaze points to that, the limit of the visual and associating the visual with power and mastery.
Okay, so Lacan is not an Indonesian artiste. I know he's got more than one name, right?
Yes.
So Jacques Lacan?
Jacques Lacan, yeah, correct. Okay. Yeah, I think I forgot, because this is probably the fifth or sixth episode we've done on him.
Yeah,
but
well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There might be people who are listening in for the first time. So just to kind of clarify
sure.
that, yes, he is not an Indonesian artiste
no.
with one name. What are the books that would, or is there a singular book for which much of what we understand from about his thinking about this issue emanates from?
Yeah, there's a compilation of transcriptions of his lectures. In fact, the bulk of his corpus are transcribed lectures. He prefers to perform his delivery rather than to write, to put down his ideas in written word. And this has largely to do with his conception of language itself, you know, as something that flows and overtakes the subject rather than something that the subject can point down and master. Language
that's very unscientific, isn't it, in some ways?
And that's one of the common charges against Lacan, right? Even other psychoanalysts feel that he is just unscientific, impressionistic, in that sense, a betrayal of the Freudian tradition. So what he did was not widely accepted by the dominant schools of psychology at the time. So one work would be ECRI, this compilation of his essays, but also another, I think next to that would be the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis.
ECRI would be spelled ECRITS.
Yeah.
Writings.
Yeah.
Writings, okay.
Yeah, basically. So that would be the main text. But he's really made more famous by his interpreters. So he's had a lot of engagements from contemporary thinkers, right? So Alain Badiou, Slavoj Žižek, they keep returning to Lacan as a resource for understanding politics, culture, and so forth. So while he...
Slavoj Žižek has that whole Lacanian take on movies, is he?
Yeah.
That, what was it? The Pervert's Guide to...
Guide to Cinema, which yeah. is also available on YouTube, because there's a video version of that as well. It's actually basically a feature-length movie where he breaks down Lacan's concepts, one of them being the gaze, which we'll talk about today, in very, very clear terms, using popular cinema as examples. Lacan's legacy endures through these contemporary figures. I'm quite sold as well in how I think he's very useful. Jargon aside, you got to peel through a lot of the terminology, a lot of the obscure ways that he writes and delivers his ideas. It can be very burdensome, but once you get there, it's very rewarding, especially if you're a social scientist or a social theorist trying to understand culture and media and politics.
I want to ask you a kind of personal question, Fuad, about this, because I know that you have an abiding interest in psychoanalysis, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for Lacan in particular, I mean, what attracts you? What problem do you think he can solve, or what questions do you think he can answer best that others have maybe not been able to answer to your satisfaction intellectually?
Okay, he's given the most satisfactory account of how subjectivity, and this is a loaded term too, but I prefer when I teach it to use the word personhood, right? The construction of our personhood. He gives a very, very satisfactory account of how we're made, right, into the ideas of who we are, right? So everybody carries a certain image, idea, assumption of their identity. But if you take a more sociological route, the idea that our identities are not God-given or they're not just natural or just obvious, then you'll need a set of tools to analyze what there is instead. And Lacan offers that in very rich ways, you know. So he begins with the assumption that we're never one. We're always at least two. So our subjectivity isn't this fully formed, coherent unity. We're in many ways marked by our attachments to the world. And this attachment takes many forms, right? One of them is being our attachments to people. But because we have to be socialized to follow rules, to think through life more than live it, we set these restrictions upon ourselves. And that's where a lot of our problems come from. This compelling desire to feel attached to the world, to others, to certain images we have to ourselves, but the way that society restricts it, right? And this is a bargain we take to function in this world, right? We have to conceal and obscure some of our desires in order to be recognized as a participant in society. And what he offers to explain why and how that works, I think is very rich.
Well, okay. So at least two, you said? At least two. So that's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, at least.
And I think, you know, if we are honest with ourselves, we have many dimensions. And that these dimensions are not obvious and they're always unfolding. So that's what makes the ability to be constantly surprised by ourselves present, right? So on one hand, it's terrifying, but on the other hand, it makes for a more interesting life. And he has signposts to better understand that.
Yeah. Okay, I look forward to part two when you're going to like sort of unpack all this good stuff for us.
Sure. Let's take a break then. We'll return for more on Lacan and the gaze in the second part of the show. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharat Kutan, as usual. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharat Kutan, and we're discussing the gaze as it was theorized by Jacques Lacan, a very iconic French psychoanalyst. You've heard of this term before, Sharat.
Yeah, the gaze as in looking at,
correct,
right?
Mm. What other gaze were you thinking about, Sharat?
Well, there's the, you know, the homonym for gaze would be G-A-Y-S,
right,
gaze, right?
Right, correct. So we're talking about the gaze.
As opposed to gays.
Correct.
Gay men or gay
good,
women.
Good clarification. Yeah, because this is an audio program.
Yes,
it is
radio.
Yeah, so we have to be clear on that. So, and he's responding to the trend of associating vision with mastery. And I guess we in the contemporary setting are more suited to see how this has transpired technologically.
Yeah, we're
right?
Very visually driven culture,
correct,
aren't we?
Yeah. And we associate that with a certain degree of control. And these days, with camera technology being more accessible, we can control how we present ourselves. We can document and photograph events around us. And this has become almost impulsive, right? Something happens, and before we even act to respond, we would take out our camera and document and share, and people will share, and discourses are created around this, and we tend to think of these images as evidential, right? As proof of something, as an experience that reflects a certain reality, right? That's how it's become impulsively. And social theory has responded to that by different ways of understanding how vision is associated with mastery, right? Like the panopticon, for example.
Well, you know, if you're kind of interested in art history, I think what becomes very clear with visual representations, that technology of representing the world through, you know, using pigmentation on canvas and such, is that the question of the optics are very important too. And so we're now going back 400, 500 years, you think of, you know, scenes that depict men looking at women, you know, but where the men are kind of half hidden from view. So they're not in view, but they are spying on, or they are sort of voyeuristically enjoying the pleasure of somebody else. And so, you know, the idea of seeing, and I think is a very old one, and, you know, awareness of it and representations of it in art are very, very clear, you know, and because later on when, you know, all kinds of optics and optical technologies were being developed, you know, whether to see the moon and stars and stuff, you have that represented in art as well.
It's very much rooted to the importance of sight to the evolutionary process as well. Human beings are very vulnerable, right? We don't have shells, we don't have feathers, we don't have fangs.
No exoskeleton.
No exoskeleton. So how we navigate the natural world depended a lot on what we could see. Right, and even that, our vision is limited, right?
But there's a really interesting little factoid I was reading on a book on, you know, kind of our natural history, is just look at your eyes. The fact that you see so much of the white of your eyes is actually there's a particular term in, you know, to describe this. And the idea is that when you compare it to our primate cousins, they don't show as much of their white of the eyes. Now, what happens is that when you have whites of the eyes, you see where the pupil is moving. And this is very good for cooperative societies. It's not very good for competitive societies. Right. You don't want to show that you've now discovered a nice juicy banana or fruit or something, you know, in the vicinity. You don't want to give it away because you're competing with all these other chaps in the neighborhood. But as soon as you work in a cooperative fashion, that's the theory at least, you need that white of the eyes, because then you can say, signal to the other chap, hey, I see, do you see what I see? We could both go for that.
That's really fascinating. It sounds quite plausible too. And I think that's how winking started. Winking probably gave us some advantage evolutionarily, and no longer does, you know, it connotes different things now. But
yes,
I can tell that the eye could speak in that sense. And it has in many ways a contemporary context. I mean, film too, right? I recall this panel in Lutz Kampung Boy, where he was talking about how they had caravan cinemas, right, to come and sell medicine into the village or something. And one of the things that they would do just to hook the audience would be to show a film. And there's a scene in Kampung Boy where the grandmother was yelling at the screen because the screen had a kissing scene from Lawrence Arabia or something like that. And the grandmother was offended, shocked, but she took it seriously as a certain kind of exposure, you know, to the eyes that otherwise would remain concealed, right? But that shows one of the power that images or visual technology has.
This
right?
was in Kampung Boy.
It was in Kampung Boy, yeah.
I don't remember it.
So Lacan enters this discussion, and he's quite advanced in this sense because visual technology was not so sophisticated at this time, to show that, you know, there's a difference between the look and the gaze. The look comes from the perspective of the subject who surveys his terrain, the subject who defines what he looks like, who believes that the eye is sort of a camera to his surroundings. And on the other hand, the gaze. The gaze is a view from the object looking at the subject.
So the object would be like, so if I'm looking at that piece of fruit, the gaze is the fruit looking at me, looking
correct.
At it.
Correct. And once you register that the subject looking is actually being looked at by his world, the subject therefore is dismantled.
Dismantled?
Correct. So think of shame. Shame is one example, right? Where you get disoriented and the safety you feel from surveying your context visually becomes questionable. And you have to kind of reconstruct yourself again, right? To pick yourself up, right? Or the anxiety of always feeling like you're being looked, right? So, for example,
like being discovered.
Being discovered, right? Or I would point this out, make this concept very basic. It's like when you're going out and you're trying to pick clothes in your wardrobe, right? Granted, you're choosing every step, right, of what to wear, but somehow at the back of your mind, you're assuming this other gaze, right?
Yeah, the people are going to be looking at you in this particular dress. It's not
correct.
Just what you see of it, but what other people will see of you wearing it.
Correct. So when you identify an object of desire in your visual gaze, that is also the other's desire, right? But mastery assumes that you have full control of that scope or field. But this sense of control is always limited because at some point, Your extent of vision will always be curtailed because you don't see anything, right? That's sort of the assumption you have. But in reality, you're always being looked at. There are always these other perspectives that are defining you, registering you in their vision, so on and so forth. And your perspective is not the final one. So at some point, that will expire and something else will intervene in that field of vision.
Was Lacan the first to kind of take notice of this dynamic?
No, Merleau-Ponty did. And this is an interesting thing where the insight did not reference clinical experience. He was referencing the phenomenological discourse of his time. So Merleau-Ponty had presumed that we assume this gaze in a way that defines and controls us, right? But Lacan is going to say that this gaze is not located anywhere. It's located in the other that we internalize psychologically. So this requires a bit of explanation on what this other is, right? So if you think about the caregiving process that a child enters the world with, this tactile embrace, this constant attention, this security and provision that the child is, for the most part, guaranteed, what also happens is the absorption of the child into the system of signs that society is going to present. And this takes place in various ways. The first is through the voice, but it's also through the gaze. So the language that the parents use do not belong to the parents. It existed before the parents were even born. And in that, as the parents talking to the child gradually enters the system of signs that society provides. What also happens is that the child is going to recognize the caregiving context visually, right? So think of a four-year-old getting his first nightmare. And the reaction would be to run, not just to run to the caregivers or the parents, but also to get that interlocking gaze with the mother or the father. You get a nightmare, you run, and what you want to look for is the father's face. That's the recognition that you aim for to feel secure. But as the child grows, the distance with the caregiving context grows even further. But that experience that you require the gaze of the other doesn't go away.
Okay, so the other then becomes more generalized. It's no longer just the parents, correct, but it could be the
social. The yeah.
Well, okay, I want to come back to something a phrase you use, a system of signs. I'm going to spell it out, SIGNS, signs. I mean, what does that actually mean? Because it sounds fairly complicated. What are we talking about? We're not talking about road signs, I know, for sure.
No. But road signs function in a certain analogous way, but in the simplest sense, you're thinking about cultural symbols, right? So what does a culture accord value to that is manifested in things that are worth looking at. So in simple ways, for example, I mean, you walk down the street, your attention is more likely to go towards an expensive car than a beautiful tree, because that's what the culture has accorded value to, right? So similarly, for example, you are more likely to be drawn to fair skin than dark skin, because that's what the culture has coded you to think and see, right? So Lacan doesn't use the word culture or society because it's too easy reified. He just uses the word the other, because there's no real source to this. There's no real place you can point to. But it is already circulated in the circumstance that we enter. So the idea of parenthood itself is a sign. The idea that the parent would tell the child certain things about what it needs to know to survive in society is culturally determined, right? By this in the context of this other. Typically, when we look at things, these things that we deem worthy of being looked at is culturally or socially ascribed. Therefore, you are not defining it. Typically, we tend to think in very solipsistic ways, right? Like the voyeur. The voyeur is looking at, say, like a political conspiracy taking place or like something salacious happening, and he thinks he's in control situation because he's not seen, right? So that's analogous to how we regard visual technology today, this privacy and control of seeing. But when we don't see how that itself is constructed by the other, therefore, that experience of mastery will always break down at some point. Either somebody discovers you and you get shocked and you get disoriented, or the meaning of what you see isn't exactly what it is, so on and so forth. There's always limits to what your vision defines.
Or you discover that, you know, the cam that's on your computer it could potentially be working against you.
That would be a great example.
I mean, I do, and I don't want to sidetrack us, but there is a question, a flag that was raised when you were describing things earlier, saying that, you know, Lacan didn't want to use the word society or culture. And I think of so many social scientists who are around that same period would have been looking at the determining force of society and culture on individual personality. I mean, that would have been already a very rich and robust discussion around
it. Correct.
Perhaps, you know, for Lacan, that was inadequate, you know, and maybe it would have been, he didn't want to get trapped within the terms that social scientists had set for themselves. So he kind of keeps it to this other thing, especially, you know, wanting to use the notion of a system of signs or representation.
It's not mutually exclusive. He uses those terms too, but I guess in a psychoanalytic framework, he wants to look at the psyche, as in the non-material part of who we are. There's a voice, and it's not really ours, you know? Then that's one of the insights that I find very interesting from Lacan, that even our most personal, intimate inner voice was internalized through the caregiving context, which was then, you know, you can regress this infinitely, you know, through the generations, that somehow this voice circulates, right?
So us. Who's speaking through us then? I mean, if you're kind of setting up us as sort of a, you know, people might go away saying, well, I'm no dummy sitting on this lap of a ventriloquist, you know, who's speaking through me. And if I was, who is that ventriloquist? I mean,
the other. The other with a capital O.
The other with a capital O, who is society,
history, culture, all those things meshed in together. And this is where we find our innermost psyche, right? So by using the other, we get this different theoretical device. It's not necessarily culture, it's not necessarily history, but it nonetheless moves us in very you know, deep ways.
Well, what about agency? I mean, that old, you know, chestnut coming out of the social sciences, you know, the idea that we have some control over things. I mean, we might not be completely self-governing. We might not be completely, you know, transparent to ourselves. And, you know, yes, we have ideas planted by society in our heads and we speak them very often, sometimes unknowingly. But there's some part of us that is still us, me.
Yeah,
Sharad, that can, you know, is that completely? And I'm willing to accept that is completely delusional. That there is nothing about me that is in some sense authentic and specific to Mr. Sherrod Kutton, born January 2nd, 1966?
There is agency, but it's animated by fantasy. It is not the liberal, rational, autonomous subject. And because it's animated by fantasy, it is very thin and very liable to break down. So Lacan is always going to point to this cycle, the cycle of the subject constructing his agency and mastery in fantasy, right? And this is as simple as us setting the goals in our heads, right? You wanting to be a good doctor. Clearly, you're animating this state of you in 15 years as this good doctor, or you wanting to be a good father. Clearly, you're animating certain... And then you make your choices out of that mental picture that you construct. And that's really the extent to which you're planning your life, your future, and you're doing this cost-benefit analysis of how to get there. But because fantasies, and there's a whole other episode we can do on fantasies, for Lacan, is only there because we lack, right? We're always going to return to this lack. We're always going to come back to when we're perplexed, when we're broken down, when we realize that our plans don't come to fruition, when our deeply cherished beliefs are easily questioned. All those things that we construct, the edifice to maintain our agency, are so easily questioned, scratched. We'll always realize where our autonomy is just fiction. Yeah, but fiction doesn't mean it's meaningless, right? So when I teach this, my students are like, but I'm real, I'm not fictional, right?
Yeah, but yeah, that's what I think.
But we are constructed out of the stories we tell ourselves. You know, our identity are stories, and they are imaginations or images that we uphold in our minds.
Okay, so, you know, I'm willing to go along with Lacan on this, you know. But at the same time, does he explain why the opposite is held to be true? Why is it that people do not experience themselves, as it were, as you know, the dummy on the lap of the ventriloquist? I mean, they experience themselves as self-governing, you know, autonomous, self-directing individuals. And that's such a powerful ideology, which is why if you put this to your students, I can't imagine anybody in your class saying, yeah, that kind of squares with my expression, my experience of life. You know, they'll be upset. They'd be resistant to that.
Well, Althusser is going to say it's interpolated, right? But I guess in a simpler way, we can just say that...
Interpolated being this idea that ideology does precisely that. It makes you think that you are the subject...
of rational self-called governance, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But if we do look at our everyday lives in a fuller sense, a lot of it is driven by passion. A lot of it is unpredictable. Loss, trauma, hurt, disappointment is as much a part of who we are. And this is the more honest picture of what the human experience is about, that this mastery... this control, this being the author of our own destiny, is too small of the bigger picture that it should warrant our core identity. And for Lacan, it's not that you're either rational or either in this constant state of fragility. It's always this cycle where the imaginary is reconstructed, right? So we in order to pick ourselves up, we have to tell certain things about ourselves, right? No, I'm worth it. I'm beautiful. I'm blah, blah, blah. I have control over my life. Stuff like that. And it's not true or false. At that point, it's just a fiction that helps you find your coherence, right? It's a valuable fiction. But then, of course, life happens and you keep breaking down, you know, and then you find yourself again in a different narrative. And that sort of reconstruction, breaking down thing shows that it reveals ultimately the perpetual lack that we keep returning to.
Okay. So is this an exercise in kind of critical thinking? I mean, just laying it out, as it were, or does it have any kind of therapeutic value? Meaning these insights into the construction of our identities and personhood, as you put it, can be used to help people cope with life?
There are differing takes on this. And Lacanian therapy itself is under attack from even other schools of psychoanalysis, never mind mainstream psychology. unless you're in Argentina or France, where they seem to be thriving. But for the most part...
Really? In Argentina and France?
Yeah. Argentina in particular. Lacan. It's not just psychoanalysis, but like the Lacanian method is prevalent. But here, I think I can defer to two sources. You can look at Bruce Fink's account of how Lacanian psychoanalysis is very useful. Or you can look at former Lacanian turned evolutionary psychologist Dylan Evans' account. He has an essay on this that explains his journey into Lacan as a psychologist and his eventual rejection of it. He's in fact written a canonical reference text on Lacanian psychoanalysis, which, you know, I use almost on a daily basis, but he's no longer Lacanian, right? So...
What do you mean you use on a daily basis? You kind of like pick a page and reflect on some sort of...
Kneel by my bedside? No. Yeah. It's just a good reference to write, you know, because Lacan is so jargon-ridden that you need a guide to explain how all those things connect and what they mean in very accessible ways. So Dylan Evans he wrote that, but he eventually renounced it all because he thinks nothing that Lacan offers is actually useful. In fact, some of it is dangerous, you know. So Andre Green as well has written some very trenchant critiques of Lacan. So I want to defer judgment on that. But I think as social theory, it offers a lot, and I'm quite happy with that for the time being.
Okay, so that's the recommendations part of the show. I'm actually, I don't have one of them. I can think of many films I've watched, actually, especially kind of done by surrealists, you know, from the early part of the century, who try to depict this multiple selves, you know, having... there's one playing in my mind right now is somebody looking at themselves, you know, this endless regress in terms of who's looking, how you're looking, and then the high point of the movie will be you meet yourself. You know, first it's all mirrors and smoke and whatever, and then suddenly you actually are confronted apparently materially with your own self. And I think they're real attempts to depict the complexities of personhood.
What movie is that?
Well, I can't remember the name at this point in time.
But we'll post the link. Yeah. But I think, okay, going back to that, that's another example that I use. When you look at yourself in the mirror, right? That's that jarring moment when, oh, that's me, right? And at that moment, you start seeing everything, your shortcomings, but also maybe a bit of vanity. All those things come together because you know that your self-constitution is a lot more than what you think or say. So that's a good experiment to end the
I'm not a vampire, but I avoid mirrors. I do.
Once again, you can always email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. That's BFM Night School. Just type that in the search space. Be sure to like that page or leave comments. This was fun, Shara. It's good to have you back. So let's make this a more regular thing.
Always a pleasure. I love to be back.
And you are at Shara Kutan on Twitter.
I am indeed.
Wonderful. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.